The two protagonists of this paper are Thomas Aquinas and Gottlieb Sohngen. And if you don't know about Gottlieb Sohngen, he was the professor of theology who taught Joseph Ratzinger and was a Bonaventurian scholar who has some articles recently translated into English in Pro Ecclesia by Ken Oates. I cannot recommend them highly enough. They were the two articles he wrote in response to Karl Barth on the question of the analogia entis. And so I'm going to build off his comments, but I just want to go ahead and just say at the beginning, these two articles by Sohngen in response to Barth in Pro Ecclesia in recent years, translated into English, are magnificent theological essays. Seeking universality in truth, goodness, and beauty, Aquinas on the science of theology in the university. It bears keeping in mind that the modern university began initially as a project of theologians thinking about the unity of knowledge. 13th century faculties in European universities at Padua, Paris, and Oxford were formed initially from cathedral schools and divided into two main bodies, the Faculty of the Arts or Humanities, which included philosophy at its summit, and the Faculty of Theology. From the beginning, the intellectual unity of the university was, as a place of learning, was far from a foregone conclusion, as if all these medieval human beings agreed on what it meant. It was more like a central problem or question that the major scholars sought to address and to theorize, often in quite different ways. Famously, they did so especially in light of the discovery of the Aristotelian corpus, since Aristotle discusses in the Posterior Analytics the diverse divisions of forms of knowledge, broadly, practical knowledge as distinct from speculative, and he gives rigorous definitions of science as such, based on the diversity of objects under consideration, so as to denote diverse speculative forms of knowledge. The great scholastic doctors of the first two centuries of university life, then, in the 13th and 14th centuries, typically sought to answer key questions that self-consciously touched directly the definition of this new enterprise, the modern university, and its meaning. And it's not even a misnomer, because they call themselves modern men. Aquinas talks about being a modern. It's an interesting question of when that term should rightly be used, but there you have it. The first question or problem was, how are the diverse forms of natural learning, although truly distinct, also coordinated and unified among themselves, and in turn open to the mystery of divine revelation? That is also far from a foregone conclusion, since you have the Latin Averroists, who at least are perceived as claiming that philosophy should hermetically seal itself off intellectually and rationally from the possibility of revelation. In short, what unifies our understanding of reality, and how is that unity close to divine revelation or open to it? The second major problem they faced was, is theology, that's to say the study of divine revelation, really itself a science in the Aristotelian sense? And if so, does it relate to our natural forms of learning? How does it relate to them? These questions are, as I hope to show, not so incidental to our current situation in the modern university, and may even be quite important to reconsider. We might begin by examining briefly how St. Thomas Aquinas addresses these questions himself. He and Albert the Great, his teacher, made it a central priority of their scholarly careers to engage in the study of the Aristotelian corpus, attempting to show its compatibility with truths of Catholic theology, but they did so by disputing with and dialoguing in a concerted fashion with the Muslim commentators on Aristotle. Of course, they were heavily immersed in the pre-existent Augustinian theological tradition, and they also took major concepts of learning from Neoplatonic literature, both Christian and non-Christian. And in the midst of this, they were trying to think more fundamentally about the relationships between faith and reason and the relationship of the unity between theology and philosophy within the diverse and the unity of the diverse disciplines of natural knowledge. So let's consider briefly three points of Thomistic teaching on these matters. First, well, I'll start here. In an early work dating from 1260, which if you remember nothing else from this lecture, please remember you should go out and read if you have not read before, Aquinas' commentary on Boethius' De Trinitate, St. Thomas sought to treat these questions mentioned in great detail. It's his most important sustained reflection on the unity of natural and theological knowledge, the commentary on Boethius' De Trinitate. The text remains normative in many ways for a perennial Catholic vision of the relationship of faith and reason. At least it has echoes that are rather profound in Vatican I and in John Paul II's encyclical Faith and Reason, Fides et Ratio. When Aquinas treats there the division of the sciences or bodies of knowledge and their unity, he makes several key distinctions. The first is between the speculative sciences, like metaphysics or mathematics, that treat knowledge of the structure of reality considered for its own sake, in keeping with Notre Dame's motto, and those practical sciences like ethics, arts, or politics that are oriented toward action and human flourishing and, you might say, world improvement, in keeping with the Yale University motto. Within speculative knowledge, then, he distinguishes three pure sciences. He considers them pure because of their objects that are distinct and utterly distinguishable. First, what he calls the philosophical study of nature, taking that object of thought from Aristotle's book, The Physics, which investigates changing material realities, ens mobile, changing being. This includes topics like what are natural forms, are there natural forms, what are the material elements of natural bodies, how can we explain change, and especially in light of causality, efficient, formal, and final causality, what is the reality of time, what is place, how can we understand the total cosmic structure, or can we, of the physical world, but also, extending into the topics of the De Anima, the nature of living things as distinct from non-living things, are there real distinctions between living and non-living forms, and what is the soul as a life principle, are there distinctively immaterial elements in human beings. We might call this, broadly speaking, the Aristotelian philosophy of the changing, perishable world. That's one fundamental object of science. Second, the study of mathematics, which is an abstract science of quantity derived from the consideration of natural bodies insofar as they have quantitative determinable dimensions. Third, and lastly, metaphysics, the study of being and of universal properties related to being, the transcendentals, like unity, truth, and goodness. And Aquinas will argue elsewhere, I would say, beauty. Now, we might ask immediately, how realistic is this schema? For example, where are the observational natural sciences, such as today we would see exemplified in the modern natural scientific study of biology, chemistry, or physics, which our world takes for granted as gold standard sciences? Actually, Aquinas is well aware of observational sciences, which existed in less developed form in his own day, but he thinks they're real, but he thinks they're a blend of the first two forms of knowledge mentioned above. In effect, the observational scientist uses measurements of reality that depend upon mathematical knowledge of quantity, the scientific study of quantity, to apply this measurement through instrumentation to the study of particular physical forms, especially considering their material and efficient causes of physical processes, their material component parts. So in this way, the observational scientist presupposes a kind of philosophy of nature and a kind of mathematical realism. And he does so by making a taxonomy of when he makes a taxonomy of natures and presupposes the real existence of their material natures, their change, their physical causality, and he doesn't have to formally investigate philosophically what these things consist in per se. In other words, the observational natural scientist doesn't have to prove that there are natural forms, that there's a difference between an amoeba and a chimpanzee. He can just presuppose that. He doesn't have to prove also that mathematics has a sort of functional interior logic. He just knows about it, and you can use it. What he does then is he studies the composition of the amoeba, the chimpanzee, or the hydrogen bond, using measurements and mathematically based tools to look at material component parts. This means you can be a scientist without being overtly a philosopher of nature, so long as you presuppose a certain amount of realism regarding our contact with nature through the senses, philosophically understood through direct experience. In this sense, the observational sciences learn more about the material structure of reality, but do not as such treat or resolve more basic philosophical questions about natural kinds and matter and causality that remain irreducible. Now, if Aquinas is right, this would suggest that the study of the genetic evolution of species, for example, in modern biology, should not be confused with the more basic, irreducibly philosophical questions about why the world exists, what it consists in, whether there are natural kinds, what chance is, what causality is, what order is, what matter is, or whether there's immateriality. Those who appeal to evolution as a factual basis for evolutionary theory to introduce anti-theistic metaphysics are appealing to the wrong science insofar as they appeal to this mixture of observational science, and in fact are making claims that are distinctively philosophical in kind, not scientific. They may be defensible, but if they're defensible, they're defensible primarily for philosophical reasons. Okay, that's enough said about sort of natural science and math. Metaphysics, meanwhile, for Aquinas, is the most universal of sciences because it applies to everything that exists. Everything has being. If it's real, it exists, it has being. And if it does, then it has a certain unity to it. It has a certain form of ontological perfection in its genus. That's to say, it has a certain kind of realization of goodness. And it has truthfulness to it because it's real and intelligible. It can be known. So, for example, a tree exists, a human being exists, the amoeba exists, the chimpanzee exists, and a star exists. And insofar as they do, there's a certain kind of unity to each one, a certain kind of intelligibility of truth content or essential understanding we can gain from them. And there's a certain kind of perfection. We could look at a more perfect chimpanzee as opposed to a less perfect one. And in some attenuated analogical sense, talk about the goodness of natural forms. Like, does that chimpanzee have good eyesight? That's not a crazy question. You could talk about a blind chimpanzee and a chimpanzee that has good eyesight. Of course, one must also study the privations that these notes of being imply. You have being, but you also have non-being. You have unity, but you also have multiplicity. You have truth, but you also have the metaphysical problem of falsehood or error. And you have goodness, but you also have the problem of evil. Natural evils, like the blindness of the chimpanzee, and in our case, moral evils. Metaphysics is a body of knowledge that studies these features of all reality and therefore is presupposed epistemologically by all other forms of knowledge. Because anything you study exists, you presuppose that it exists when you study it. People who study, for example, the developmental formation of stars or the psychology of child development or the ethics of just war might infrequently ask what these things really are or why they are in their deepest roots, but what they study does exist. Metaphysics touches also upon that which is deepest in reality, the common being in all things, the being that's present in all things. Due to this fact, it's also a science open to the question of ultimate causality and immaterial reality. That's to say, whether there is whether monotheism is true, whether God causes all things to exist, and therefore is the author of common being or the being present in all things. But also metaphysics is open to the question of the immaterial human soul and the possibility of angelic beings, because it can talk about whether these things exist. Do we have immaterial souls? Is that a religious myth, or is it a reality? If there's a transcendent and immaterial reality, it is not known about by the study of quantity or through observational sciences, or even the philosophical consideration of material natural kinds. It's known about through metaphysical reflection upon existence. So thinking about existence for Aquinas is a prelude or foundation for our capacity to think about the transcendent mystery of God in his being, his unity, his goodness, and his truthfulness. The transcendental notions can be extended from this world, where they're common to all things, to a script by analogical ascription predication, to the hidden cause of all things that is, as it were, concealed from us, as it were, you might say, behind, above, beneath the density of created beings, which conceal in a way God from us, but to whom we can ascribe these transcendental notions in an imperfect and analogical sense. Now, this is all philosophy. For Aquinas, God enters into the science of metaphysics not as the proper subject of that science. That's to say, metaphysics is not primarily about God. Avicenna had claimed this. But Aquinas teaches that metaphysics studies being in the things that we experience around us, you might say in creatures, and God enters into metaphysics as the transcendent cause of the subject matter of consideration. You might indulge me by allowing me to say that that's a rather secular idea. Philosophy really studies this world and the being of the things of this world, and God enters into philosophy as a kind of on the horizons as a transcendent cause of the subject matter of the study of philosophy. So you might say he enters into the discipline naturally at its horizon or summit as we come gradually to consider what the transcendent cause is of all that exists, that truth that gives unity to all other created and lesser truths. Okay, what should we conclude from all this? The universality of the university and its diverse disciplines that seek to understand the whole nature of being in all its different domains is grounded for Aquinas in the universality of our knowledge of all that exists. The natural study that pertains in an especial way to this topic is metaphysics, and metaphysics is open from the top up, so to speak, to the question of the universal cause of all that exists, which is God, who gives being to all that is, and who is present in all that exists as its mysterious, numinous, transcendent cause. So God's not the immediate subject of study that unifies the natural learning of the university. It's actually not God, for Aquinas, that gives unity to university disciplines as a subject of study, but it's just created being. It's everything that exists that can be studied in different ways. But God is the proximate and transcendent subject that unites all learning as the unifying cause of that which exists in creation, so that if you didn't have that horizon open to God, it would start to endanger the intelligibility of the unity of learning. Now, other medievals sought to arrange this conceptual material very differently and in interesting ways. But typically, there was agreement throughout the 13th and 14th centuries that Christian philosophy in the university should be what the late Dutch scholar Jan Eertsen called transcendental thought. That's to say, not in a Kantian sense, thought centered around the transcendentals. As mentioned, these are properties coextensive with being. That's to say, the university is a place concerned above all with being, truth, goodness, and indeed beauty, and their privations. Why is this the case? For philosophical reasons, because the university aspires to genuine intellectual universality in the natural order. But also adjacent to this shared Christian philosophical conviction is the theological doctrine of creation. All that exists is from God and bears marks of his uncreated being, uncreated truth, goodness, and beauty. At the same time, the revelation of God to Israel and to the Apostolic Catholic Church reveals to us the inner life of the Holy Trinity. You might say the being, life, truth, and life of God in himself as Father, Word, and Spirated Love. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but it's interesting that the medievals confidently took the transcendental notions up to, you might say, a third order, from just being something present in all things, insofar as they exist, to being naturally predicable, in Aquinas' case by analogy, to God as the created author of all being, philosophically, to notions that can be ascribed in another, yet higher, you might say, theological, analogical register, to the mystery of the Holy Trinity. So you can talk about the eternal, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit is eternal love, or you can talk about the Word as the generated truth of the Father. So the universality of being turns out to stem in a theological light, in light of divine revelation, from a universality of the life of the Holy Trinity, a creative life of eternal contemplation and love, of the eternal procession of the Word and of the Spirit, through whom God has made all things. So now all the lower registers of being are intelligible utterly, ultimately, in light of the mystery of the inner life of the Holy Trinity, which is interiorly fecund through generation spiration, but exteriorly creative through communicating being and goodness and the grainy reality, the grit of reality, to us in our created form. Trinitarian theology does not do violence to our human knowledge of creation, you might say our transcendental knowledge. On the contrary, it illuminates it from a higher source in ways compatible with and assimilative of our natural forms of knowledge. Reflection on the Holy Trinity, therefore, makes use of metaphysical knowledge of the divine attributes of the one God. Reflection, likewise, on man in the state of grace and as fallen and as wounded by original sin or as redeemed by Christ, all great theological topics of anthropology, makes use of natural knowledge of human persons. So the philosophical study of human nature is not in tension or irreconcilable opposition to the theological anthropology. Just as the study of Christ makes use of the philosophical study of the human body and soul, it's when we talk about the body and soul of Christ as truly human and is intelligible, therefore in part in philosophical terms. If theology shows that the world of being is a created world stemming from Trinitarian life and divine interpersonal communion, natural learning aids us to understand by analogy the mysteries of the faith, Trinity, human salvation, and incarnation, because our natural learning about the mystery of God, human nature, body and soul, can contribute to building up a deep understanding of theological mysteries. So what have we sought to establish so far in these reflections? First, that Aquinas and others who were at the start of the university life of Europe believed that there were divisions to the diverse disciplines based on their irreducibly distinct objects, but also unity and integration based on the universality of being in all things. Second, that there is a philosophical centrality to metaphysics in the life of the university, the science of the transcendentals. Last, that the theological doctrine of creation and the philosophical doctrine of the transcendentals overlap significantly. At its heights, speculative reason is naturally open to revelation because it's concerned with all that exists. And revelation is assimilative of natural reason because it illumines all that exists. The university is unified, then, by both the work of theology and philosophy, faith and reason, in complex but intelligible ways. The consideration of God has a central place in both these disciplines of philosophy and theology, and maintains a kind of center of gravity to human thought within the universal aspiration and scope of ambitions that form university intellectual life. That's the first part of the essay, and now I'm going to transition to more like our problems and Sōngun. Now today, this whole vision is, you might say, this set of questions or problems that the medievals were trying to solve could be inverted. We ask today, not so much theologically, whether philosophy could be shown to be open to revelation, but how and whether there can really be philosophy within theology at all. You might think about a very noteworthy option, that of Karl Barth, who's an incredibly sophisticated theorist who doesn't really want to have a formally distinct philosophical moment within theology, and is quite self-conscious about how he realizes that project on a massive scale. And you have another shade of this, totally different, in Jean-Luc Marion. Okay, just to give some obvious examples of people who problematize the medieval conversation in creative ways and in interesting ways. Correspondingly, can there be any place for Catholic theology or of Christian theology more generally within the secular modern university? The first question that I asked has its remote origins in the Kantian critique of metaphysics, and proximately, you might say, it's characterized by the famous 20th century debate between Barth and Chavara regarding the analogy of being and its use in theology. The crisis of confidence in the classical model became widespread within Catholic theological circles, to be sure, and today we might ask, can we realistically hope for renewal of a classical synthesis of faith and reason if we are bound to do that by making use of the traditional terms of classical metaphysics? The second question we face, that of the secular, I mean the more secular question, like why would theology even be present in the university? Well, it has its historical roots in the French Revolution, to be sure, which sought self-consciously to redirect the work of the Sorbonne in view of intra-worldly enlightenment political ends, divorced definitively from academic study of divine revelation. The Sorbonne was the first university that banned this teaching of theology, and to this day it's illegal for a Catholic priest to teach in a French university. They've been wonderfully consistent. And that's had interesting and somewhat positive effects on theology in France, by the way. We should turn to that conversation eventually. Of course, the German and English Enlightenment found other solutions and integrated theology into the modern university differently from one another, often in a Protestant context. Catholic universities in America offer a modern model that is basically an outlier in regard to Northern Europe. Basically, however, Catholic theology today is typically in North America and much of Northern Europe, at least, an underground movement, academically speaking, marginalized from public academic life. This is a secondary consideration, however. Even more primary is the loss of a clear sense of the unity of secular university life itself as a life of learning, which John Cavadini rightly and strongly stressed. This lack of unity has at least four causes, historically speaking. Well, first, the loss of reference to divine revelation in the 18th century, as aforenoted. Second, and closely following, philosophical skepticism regarding philosophical treatments of classical notions of philosophical realism, at least since the time of Hume and Kant, which called into question in turn traditional visions of the person, the world, and natural knowledge of God. Third, I'll put this in slightly polemical terms, ambient despair of a unified form of knowledge that has been engendered in part by postmodern skepticism of the sort that we derive from Nietzsche, Heidegger, and Foucault, even in the face of Kantian liberalism, which was the last refuge of traditional thinking, arguably, and most recently, the practical effects of hyper-specialization of disciplines and the consumerist, economically motivated technocracy of the university centered on business and science innovation as the primary aims of university education linked to capitalism. Now, paradoxically, in this context, Catholic theology is important in hidden but suggestive ways. Allow me to turn in this final part of the paper to the thought of the understudied 20th century Catholic theologian Gottlieb Sohngen. Sohngen was a diocesan priest who taught theology at the University of Munich. Expert in Bonaventure, he is most well known for his response to the Bart-Chavara debate and for the fact that he supervised the doctoral work of the young Joseph Ratzinger. In many ways, his ideas on faith and reason are reflected deeply in Benedict XVI's famous Regensburg lecture with its strong Augustinian connotations in the Reflections on the University, Revelation, and Reason. Now, Sohngen published two articles in the journal Catholica, Theology Journal, in 1934, in response to Bart and Chavara, on the Catholic notion of the analogy of faith in relation to the analogy of being, the so-called analogia fidei, which is, you know, a term in Bart, but it means something different in Catholic theology, and really was developed as a kind of theme in Catholic theology in the late 19th century. Now, in this paper, these two papers he published, he stressed four points regarding what the analogy of faith or analogia fidei consists in Catholic thought. And each of them has an interestingly profound bearing on our topic. So I'm going to consider them each briefly. You really should read the article, but I'm going to allude to them and try to suggest ways they speak to our contemporary fragmented university intellectual life. So the first has to do with ultimate explanations. Sohngen notes that the unity of the mystery of God in its diverse elements of revelation calls forth a sense of the unity of all knowledge. This occurs in a twofold way. Let me explain. First, there's an intelligible unity present within the diverse mysteries of faith. So, for example, the theologian considers the mystery of the Holy Trinity as it relates to the mystery of God's designs in creation and the missions of the Word and the Spirit, the Incarnation and the Atonement, the resurrection of Christ, the Church as a mystery, the sacraments, the life of grace. All these elements of mystery cohere. So if there's an internal logos or rationality in the highest echelon of reality, in God's own eternal Word and in the mysteries that unfold from God, the Trinity, then there's reason to have confidence in the rationality of God's work in creation and history. You might say in this sense that if theology impresses upon the theologian the burden of seeking intelligibility at the highest levels of reality in the Trinity and in the work of the Trinity, then the theologian should presuppose that there's logos, that there's rationality in lower registers of reality. Second, then, and this is still in the first point, this unity of revealed knowledge is present in theology while still respecting the distinction of nature and grace. Therefore, the Catholic theologian must recognize the integrity of natural knowledge as itself a united knowledge open to revelation. Well, you have to respect the unity of nature. If grace is a gift, then it's a gift given to something. And that means there's something that we have in the realm of nature and of knowledge that is not grace and not faith. And that has to be in some way capable of receiving and being open to revelation. So in short, the universality of truth made available in divine revelation calls forth or invites a confidence in the unity of our natural knowledge of the world. Divine logos revealing itself, you might say, calls forth confidence in human logos. This is a standard theme in Ratzinger's writings. It's paradoxical. It's like that after the Enlightenment, you have this crisis of confidence in the unity of and universality of reason, and actually divine revelation initiates confidence in natural human reason as a consequence or as an echo of the claim that we're capable of knowing and of receiving theological knowledge, properly speaking, of God's own mystery. Second, another theological idea, the unity of the canon, that's to say of the Old and New Testaments. This was alluded to by Professor Cavadini with regards to the crisis of kind of the deep hermeneutics of theological biblical reading. Sonkin points out that if the scriptures are not merely a human religious artifact, but are also and above all the inspired word of God, then they must have an internal unity. Book speaks to book, author speaks to author, idea speaks to idea, in no matter how complicated a fashion, we have to posit an ultimate unity. So in this case, biblical hermeneutics, however complex its texture, is ultimately a reflection on the truth of history in light of God and as reflective of God. History can have an internal meaning. We can discover. We don't just project or create. Now this implies that there's a hermeneutical realism about texts in correspondence to ontology. The texts ultimately refer us back to the nature of reality. The realism of biblical faith calls forth a broader confidence in the unity of reason in interpreting texts within history so as to seek a common truth through conversation, or seeking through inevitable controversies and conflicts to resolve what is true. So this has implications for hermeneutics more generally and normatively, that in literature and history, we're actually ultimately seeking in complex ways the truth of the nature of things. Third, the unity of church proclamation and biblical witness. So Sonkin emphasizes there's a coherence between what the church teaches and what the Bible reveals, or you might say that what the Bible reveals gives rise to the clarifications of what the church teaches. They're not on two tracks or unrelated. Catholic theology presupposes that the church discerns and declares formally over time as true apostolic teaching what is based on the original revelation of God, and that this progressive development of doctrine that occurs in the church does so in an organic way in continuity with the past and in anticipation of the future. Of course, I'm alluding here to John Henry Newman, and so was Sonkin. Now, this means in concrete practice that the church confronts the bewilderingly vibrant developments of the natural sciences, history, anthropology, or bioethics in the light of Revelation with hope for a collective ecclesial effort in finding the common truth of things synthetically over time, as with, for example, the example that John Cavadini gave of human origins and original sin, distinctiveness, character of the human person. How can philosophers, anthropologists, paleontologists, biologists, and theologians over time come to a kind of erudite, nuanced understanding or reasonable set of claims, possibly, about human origins? That's a collective group project. It takes time. It's a collaborative one. Now, this theological project of integrating truths over time in light of dogmas, in the light of the biblical revelation as clarified by the church, corresponds analogically in the natural order to the hope of universality in the community, that seeks to find the natural truth of all things through time in cooperation among different disciplines with patients unified by a common thread of realism in the midst of an interdisciplinary search. And everybody talks about this, and we know it's very difficult to realize and that the siloed character of the practices of professional academics is perhaps as acute as it has ever been. So, it's an aspiration that seems to be, in principle, absolutely necessary. And Sonkin is showing how there's got to be he's suggesting there's a natural corollary to development of doctrine that could happen in the university as you integrate the developmental knowledge that transpires in different disciplines into a greater whole. Finally, for Sonkin, all of this study of divine revelation, the 3 points made above, the study of the intrinsic knowledge of the mysteries, the study of the coherence of the hermeneutics of biblical theology, and the coherence of church teaching through time in the light of new knowledge in coherence with traditional doctrine and scripture, that all has to be correlated with the analogia entis, the philosophical consideration of the transcendental features of being in creation that themselves evoke naturally the possibility of rational knowledge of God and allow us to demonstrate the human mind is intrinsically open to divine revelation, not closed to it. Now that is today the study of the, that is to say, today the study of the mystery of revelation is always also conducted against the backdrop of metaphysical philosophy, so that there's the consistent presupposition for Sonkin of the harmony of divinely revealed truth and natural reason. Practically, today, this means that the modern secular university could, in principle, profit from Catholic theologians when they reflect these four concerns of Sōngen, not only the fourth of them, but the fourth is especially important. To show how real knowledge of being, unity, truth, goodness, and beauty are possible, and how such knowledge suggests the possibility of divine revelation as a rational possibility. This doesn't need to be shown simply philosophically. It needs to be shown in other disciplines in their own ways, because the truth about human existence can also be shown by reading Thucydides, or studying history, or looking at literary motifs that in fact have a philosophical foundation in the nature of the human person or human society, or, for example, in political science, which is closely adjacent to political philosophy. But also, the theologian can show how the study of the transcendentals can be integrated into the living claims of Catholic theology. Thinking about being, truth, goodness, and beauty must be integrated into and manifest from within our thinking about the mystery of God, the Trinity, the person of Christ, and the mystery of the Church. And in his own way, Balthasar has attempted to do a project like to articulate a project like this. As one might suspect, as a Thomist, I have some suspicions or concerns, but I think there are about the, you know, the dereliction theology and some of the intertrinitarian kenosis. But those are, in a certain way, internal family concerns, because the larger aspiration is one in which Balthasar is deeply influenced overtly by both Aquinas and Sōngen. And so I think that the conversation between Balthasar and Aquinas continues to be an interesting one from the point of view of the things that I'm highlighting. I finish. The modern university is in fact haunted, perhaps, by a crisis of meaning. I say that as somebody who travels around and talks to undergraduates who are often, I think it's fair to say, very deeply bewildered at what they've received by the time they're seniors and do not feel like they have a deeply integrated understanding of reality. The proposals I've made here are, of course, classically Aristotelian, Augustinian, and Thomistic, and that is to say medieval in origin. And they could be arguably, you know, you could say that they're nostalgic or unrealistic. You might say that, especially if you think we've irrevocably left the Middle Ages. I'll just finish with this slight provocation. Remy Brog recently made a very cleverly stated argument in which he claimed that it's not the case that we've left the Middle Ages, but we're only living out one version of them, now in full blossom, which took many of its central ideas from William of Ockham, took them quite seriously, and developed a framework around them. Now, Brog's thought experiment is not meant to bind us to his coy genealogy, but only to suggest that, in fact, we are still basically living within arguments framed many centuries before us, and we are free so as not to be bound by the determinations taken in a previous century or so. The future requires of us, or it invites us to, a ressourcement, a renewal by going back to sound resources so as to move forward in profound ways that are completely contemporary. For this, we should look again to the realism and confidence of the Christian Aristotelian revolution of the first era of the university, and at its center, we can be helped by thinking about the thought of Thomas Aquinas. Thank you very much.
I'm thankful for the opportunity to reply, even at short notice. Responding to a paper with which one wholeheartedly agrees is a funny kind of challenge in its own way. Father White's description of the Thomistic view of the unity of knowledge within the university properly understood and ordered, as well as his portrayal of the disunity of knowledge in the modern university and the historical causes behind it, all seem correct to me. My first question is an anthropological one that I believe has a bearing on the question of the goal of the unity of knowledge within the university. Aquinas relies heavily on the claim that human beings are curious critters. It's part of what defines us. By nature, we desire to know the causes of things. He puts it this way in the Prima Secundae of his Summa. When man knows an effect and knows that it has a cause, there naturally remains in the man the desire to know about the cause, what it is. And this desire is one of wonder and causes inquiry. For instance, if a man, knowing the eclipse of the sun, consider that it must be due to some cause, and know not what the cause is. He wonders about it, and from wondering proceeds to inquire. Nor does this inquiry cease until he arrive at the knowledge of the essence of the cause. End quote. Other animals don't behave this way. It does not bother a panda not to know the process by which leaves convert sun energy into plant tissue. So long as there are leaves to eat, they don't care. Humans are different. To be sure, there are practical benefits to understanding the process of photosynthesis. It's the utilitarian notion of why we want to know. But more than this, humans simply wish to know how and why the process occurs. Just as we want to know why the sun went dark at noon that one day. Wasn't that weird? This much is an uncontroversial statement, it would seem. And yet I wonder if there aren't reasons to begin to question at least the extent to which Aquinas's just quoted and seemingly undeniable claim remains true of the modern Western mind. I want to choose my words carefully here, lest I come across as too cynical or uncharitable or guilty of psychoanalyzing. I mean to raise the possibility whether, consciously or unconsciously, many, not all but many, modern, often secular thinkers place limits on this desire to know causes. Call it the this far and no further attitude towards wonder. While modern minds may intuit or privately admit to themselves that knowledge within the university today is not integrated, they nevertheless feel a resistance to address this problem by turning back to the resources of classical metaphysics and to a more expansive menu of forms of causation, final causes, etc. Even if they do see some wisdom in these ideas and texts and suspect that they are still the best answers humans have been able to come up with to this point in history on questions of the unity of reality and knowledge. So why this resistance? Presumably because down the path of the pre-modern view of reality and the university lies, eventually, theology, religion, and so much of what the modern West would prefer to keep at bay, those ghosts of the medieval world. The modern imagination, influenced by postmodernism, which Father White mentions as a significant factor in the turn away from the Catholic view of the university, is, as literary critic George Steiner writes, more or less at ease with the manifold discourse of uncertainties, for it perceives in this multiplicity and indeterminacy of possible discourses and metaphoric modelings a guarantor of tolerance. It suspects in any thirst for absolutes the old cruel demons of dogma. Where's Professor Wilkin? Yes, need to talk to him about dogma. Literary theorist Hans Gumprecht provides a case in point. Against the grain of his guild, he finds himself longing for a form of, quote, being that refers to things of the world before they become part of culture. Aquinas would simply call this essences or truth. He goes on to speak of tangible things seen independently of their culturally specific situations, end quote. And yet, despite these longings, Gumprecht, who I think is representative, that's why I bring him up, nevertheless opts for a sort of principled reluctance to a return to a pre-modern understanding of objective metaphysical truth, as is required for a university of the kind described by Father White to ever get off the ground. Gumprecht explains his reluctance this way, quote, given where the trajectory of Western thought has led us, given also the devastating political impact during the past few centuries of philosophies and ideologies based on ontological premises and on claims to absolute truth, we may indeed have no real alternative for most practical purposes to the range of worldviews that we subsume under names like constructivism or pragmatism. But inhabiting worlds, and the plural is important here, that we want to be shaped and constructed by changing sets of concepts, discourse, and narratives, obviously produces a desire for what these concepts, discourses, and narratives, at least seen from a constructivist or pragmatic perspective, no longer even pretend to touch. In other words, Gumprecht's desire to know the cause of things, the true essence of things, is trumped by an even greater desire, an even greater wish, to never again return to philosophies and ideologies based on ontological premises. So you can imagine what you think of Aquinas' university as well. In the mind of modern academics like Gumprecht, metaphysics is dangerous given its bad track record of social consequences. Compare Gumprecht's sentiments with that of Father White's when he describes the true spirit of the university, properly structured, in which striving to know and enjoy capital T truth, beauty, and goodness are at the very heart of the mission. As Father White writes, channeling Aquinas, the university should be, quote, centered around the transcendentals. They are properties coextensive with being. The university is a place concerned above all with being, truth, goodness, and indeed beauty and their privation. This leads me to my second question. What should those who support Aquinas' view of the university say to those in the academy who simply reject, out of hand, this Platonic assumption that truth, beauty, and goodness are objective and finally one? Beauty and goodness are subjective, they may say. Many of my students do feel this way. And truth, at least of certain kinds, is alone objective. Could it be that many in the modern university reject Plato's transcendentals and their convertibility before they ever get around to implicitly siding with nominalism? Occam's the usual culprit in this story, but maybe it goes deeper. And if this is the case, how should Catholic thinkers address this additional Platonic problem? Or to take the matter further and to a degree that would have made even Occam squirm, consider modern philosophers who dispute whether truth itself, never mind beauty and goodness, is unifiable. I'm not making this up. Philip Kitcher, for instance, has questioned the working assumption on the part of philosopher Thomas Nagel that multiple valid truths about our universe must finally be reconcilable if they are all valid truths. So much for the principle of non-contradiction. The particular occasion for Kitcher's remarks dealt with the reality of the brain and consciousness. Kitcher imagines and predicts a future in which, quote, it may fall to some neuroscientist to explain the illusion of unity, a last twist on successful accounts of many subspecies of mental processes and functions. Or perhaps it will be clear by then that the supposed unity of mind and value were outgrowths of a philosophical mistake, understandable in the context of a particular stage of scientific development, but an error nonetheless. What would Aquinas say to those who would deny the very unity of knowledge and who would presumably therefore react differently to calls for the integration of knowledge within the university? Lastly, Father White references Remy Brog as claiming that the university is, without realizing it, actually living out Occam's project. How, if Aquinas' model of the university is the correct one, will Occam's university come to an end? As it would seem it must, if it is based in error, in fundamental misunderstandings about the nature of reality, and thus the true form of the university. What, in other words, will its failure look like? At a place like Duke University, and I'd be curious to hear from Professor Griffiths whether he thinks this is a libertarian institution. At a place like Duke, where 30,000 of 40,000 employees work in the medical complex, where specialization is the name of the game, where the natural sciences, whose recent developments Father White calls bewilderingly vibrant, where those natural sciences reign in terms of respectability and financial investment, where techno-optimism is palpable, where the Stanfordification, I don't know if you've heard that term, it's a good one, of higher education is on display in STEM classes filled to the brim, while some humanities departments, many given over to postmodern thought, have embarrassing faculty to student major ratios. At a place like this, how will the discontent for unified knowledge manifest itself? And how would a truly Catholic model, Aquinas' model, ever emerge? Thank you.
It seems to be, with this question of subalternation of the sciences and this commentary on Boethius stuff, it seems to be kind of two possible models for what you do with the fact that the disciplines all have these really disparate objects, that they're irreconcilably disparate. And one is to say that the higher discipline can't learn anything from the lower discipline sort of by definition, because it just articulates a different kind of knowledge, and so it can't be informed by it. And then the other one is maybe to say, well, there has to be some kind of feedback loop or feedback mechanism whereby you can sort of learn from what's below. And I'm thinking about I went to a talk actually yesterday on medieval medicine, and it was really interesting because there are lots of little cases in which medicine is a subdiscipline of, you know, other physics, or and it has its, but medical practitioners were sort of saying, you know, well, you know, maybe these things that Galen was saying in this case were wrong, and there was this attitude of, well, we can't learn from the practitioners because we have the first principles. So I guess my question is, I'm guessing we probably all want something of a feedback loop, but if there is, what's the theoretical ground for it, and would it allow us to do something like, for example, in your example of evolution, maybe the metaphysician has better reason now to say that there's, you know, one or two or three natural kinds instead of 400,000. I'm not committed to that view myself, but, you know, just as an example of where you might have a kind of, you know, is there a sort of bottom-up feedback in your view?
Yeah. Well, okay, that's a great question. So I think it's obvious that there is. I can't see how you could hermetically seal off the highest of the sciences for Aquinas, which is theology, or for that matter, metaphysics, from being deeply affected by studies at lower levels, so to speak, if we can use that higher, lower spatial imagery. So the classic example is in the discovery of the Erastian corpus in Christianity, adjusting to the notion that the intellect receives its knowledge through the activity of the agent intellect. That's a specifically philosophical discovery, which Catholic theology deeply adapted to, and hylomorphism, which is, the two are closely interrelated. So the idea that over and against kind of Neoplatonic theories that man is two substances and that the intellect receives its light directly from illumination from above without extracting it through abstraction from the senses, you have the Erastian revolution, which posits that the human being is one substance of the soul informing the body, and that the human being extracts its knowledge through the human being enlightening. Now, that's a philosophical idea, right? Okay. But it changed theology. And so the point is, if you can put it this way, for Aquinas, if he can assimilate that much philosophy that's novel into theology, then why couldn't it's less controversial to assimilate modern scientific truths into philosophy of nature? If you can do it, if you can affect the highest sciences, actually science of divine revelation, by new knowledge from below, then why couldn't you do it for philosophy from new knowledge from below? And he's constantly interested in scientific examples. He gives them. Some of them are today realistic. Some of them are today not that realistic. But Maritain talks about this a little bit. I mean, there's famous arguments about this in the 20th century Thomists between people like Maritain and degrees of knowledge and people like William Wallace and Benedict Ashley of the River Forest School. But they do fundamentally all agree that the philosophy of nature has to rethink the application or the articulation of its principles, sometimes in light of new knowledge. So, I mean, a famous question is material elements. Aristotle does think there are material elements in every natural body, but he thinks of them in ways that are not so easily congruent with modern science. And then you have the discovery of the chemical, the structure of the periodic table, chemical elements, and atomic, and, you know, further down, material elements. And can that be squared with an Aristotelian concept of substantial form? Good question. Lots of literature has been written arguing, I think, very coherently for and very persuasively of how it's absolutely compatible. But that work's already been done in a way. But the fact that they felt like they had to do it, or they feel like they have to do it, shows you that the question's already being answered. I mean, another example is this: we have a Dominican of my province who recently finished his thesis on virtue ethics and modern neuroscience, looking at how the brain is functioning in the ways we build up patterns of habitual virtue or vice. Think about addictions, addictions to alcohol or addictions to pornography, which are, obviously very wide-reaching in our society. Well, what's going on there physiologically in the brain, as well as what's, going on in terms of the free decisions of the person to try to expand their freedom or regain their freedom or, live in a moderate and temperate way. That's an integrated knowledge. That's a knowledge of ethics and a knowledge of the human person that is also really aided by, or at least deeply affected by, the acquisitions of modern neuroscience. And I think that kind of vitality actually shows the why this perennial thought form has such, endurance. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Father Thomas Joseph. I have a question, actually, sort of about illumination, since this follows nicely from the first question. So you mentioned Thomas's notion that the subordinate disciplines most fundamentally presuppose a kind of intuition of esse commune, sort of common being that metaphysics studies. And I was struck by your comment about that it's that it marks a sort of secularizing moment in Thomas's thought. It's an attempt to stake out a kind of relative independence for the subordinate disciplines. And it seems to me that even in Thomas's own lifetime, that move struck Bonaventure in particular as
risky.
Secularizing.
Yeah.
Bonaventure famously says in Book 5 of the Itinerarium that he agrees with Thomas that what falls first in the intellect is being, but not, he says, not analogous being, which I take to be his version of Thomas's common being, but rather divine being, that what's presupposed to every judgment. Every human judgment is, in fact, a kind of intuition of the existence of God, and that strikes me as a more radical way of staking out the kind of theological substructure of all of the university disciplines. They're all sort of already theological,
mm-hmm.
by virtue of their dependence on this intuition of divine being.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if so why not take that further step,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of go whole hog on the...
No, I really disagree with that move. I mean, that's a famous controversy. So you have people who think that, for example, you have kind of semi-Aristotelians who think that you extract knowledge of lower realities through the agent and intellect, but you have infused notions of the transcendentals that allow you to kind of go directly up toward God through infused knowledge. And that's not a rare option in some ways. And of course, Scotus follows Aquinas on this, but he thinks Aquinas does not assure enough continuity between our natural knowledge derived from abstraction with the knowledge of God that we need to build off of it due to Aquinas' analogical predication theory, and that's why he, in part, is motivated to create the univocal predication theory. We abstract enough to almost univocally ascribe names to God from being around us. But, okay, so behind all this is really partly the reception of the ontological argument of Anselm. Do we really have intuitive a priori knowledge of God and of infinite being? And, you know, Bonaventure follows and develops the Anselmian thinking in a very, you know, direct and very profound way. Aquinas is an opponent to the ontological argument. I think that two things that are commend, two reasons I like what Aquinas does, and I think it's to be commended to us, is one is he's actually worried about having real knowledge of God as opposed to ideological constructs that we can ourselves fashion. So you might say he has concerns here in the Catholic tradition that overlap somewhat with traditions in the Reformed, that we see in the Reformed of man's mind as a factory of idols, or at least a factory of concepts that we could project onto God that might not actually have warrant. You see this also in Kant's attempt to demolish the natural knowledge of God and the Critique of Pure Reason and with the antinomies. Aquinas is less extreme than Kant or, you know, Barth, but there's a worry about how you get there to thinking constructively about God in natural theology or in metaphysical philosophical theology. And I think his caution at the beginning about where he's getting his concepts from by committing to the fact that they do come primarily from abstraction, from created forms around us, allows him to build up a progressive account of how we gain knowledge of God that's much more careful and more warranted and ultimately, therefore, more cataphatically well-founded. That's so you can make positive ascriptions about God that are well-founded. And I think Scotus has this kind of worry, too, against Bonaventure, if I understand that rightly from Tim Noon. But the other side is that what I like about Aquinas is he preserves a lot of apophaticism. The natural knowledge of God we have is, because derived primarily from our knowledge of the things of this world, numinous, dark. It is, we can posit true significations of God, but we don't experience God as he is in himself. So we can truly speak of God, but we're also confronted with the limitations of our natural knowledge of God. So I think that's a very nice balance that he achieves, and it's got a lot of realism to it. But I'm also deeply committed to the fact that our abstract concepts are derived from sensate abstraction. I think Aquinas is just right about that Aristotelian point. So I'm kind of willing to defend him against Bonaventure, but that's a great and old and wonderful argument, you know, in the Catholic world.
Just a footnote. I think Barth in 2:1 references Sondren and says if that's the analogia entis, I can almost agree with
the precise articles I was referring to. Which, that's one of the reasons when anyone interested in Barth must read these articles, because Barth, when he read these two articles, I mean, they're just wonderful theology. But when you read them, you also see why Barth could feel like he could take a deep step toward them. I don't think he goes all the way, but it's what he felt was, and he said this is not really what Catholics believe about the analogia entis.
That's right.
But I disagree with him. I fundamentally disagree with him. I think Sonnegan does a very fine job of articulating a classical Catholic conception of the analogia fide and the analogia entis. And I think he's preferable on Thomas terms to Chavara. You know, because Chavara famously claimed that the analogia entis is the fundamental form of Catholic theology. Well, that form, that word means kind of, in Chavara speak, nature. So like the essence. Well, how can natural theology be the essence of Catholic dogmatic theology? It can't be. And Balthasar criticizes Chavara for this, and Sonnegan criticizes Chavara for this, and I think they're right about that. Even though Chavara is really an understudied and under-respected brilliant man, I think that on this point, Balthasar and Sonnegan are preferable. And Barth sensed, I think Barth overreacted to Chavara on his own terms, but I also think he didn't get the best presentation of the analogia entis from Chavara, and Balthasar was trying to repair that.
Then I just have one question. What of your arguments does the curriculum of a university should it look like?
Yeah, I mean, those are the kinds of questions I feel that's a fantastic question, and it's one I feel like I probably ought to try to I have dual conflicting feelings. Like, I should try to have an answer to that question, and I must avoid scrupulously ever trying to have an answer to that question. I will say this kind of arch traditional thing. I think that it is very helpful to students to gain a common vocabulary and analytic unity in approaching reality through a serious and intensive study of the works of Aristotle as read in the Timistic tradition. I don't think that, I mean, I'm not imagining that being mandated at every university. People don't immediately ascribe to, you know, they always think that Dominicans and Thomists are like interested in authoritarianism, which is strangely very voluntaristic, and we shouldn't be voluntaristic people, even though some of us have become, unfortunately, voluntaristic people. That's not my concern. It's not political. I do think students are aided by a sort of deep encounter with the Aristotelian corpus, which, of course, presupposes other things like Plato and besides Aristotle. You can't really study Aristotle and Aquinas without knowing something about Plato and Augustine. But I think if you have a kind of study of Aristotelian disciplines, it is helpful. I think a lot of people, when they read the Nicomachean Ethics seriously for the first time, realize they've confronted something vibrantly realistic. At least that's my sense. So I think by extension, that kind of process. But I also think it would be terrible to have a monolithically philosophical and theological education that wasn't also a broad liberal arts education encompassed by history and literature. And I do actually think the politics of identity people are right, that it's not always evident what the choices there should be, because of the works that might be most philosophically universal need not be the works that are necessarily from one's own home culture. And at the same time, there is a kind of a coherence to one's own local, national patrimony, and I think that deserves also some attentiveness, because there is a kind of cultural good in being grounded in a tradition that's more local. But that's a delicate and more philosophically enigmatic topic. So I put more of the emphasis on classical studies of Aristotle and Aquinas. I don't know what the motivations are for that for students. I talked to Tal Brewer once about this, who's at University of Virginia. Could at UVA, could you have like a class that's fundamental, like freshman intro to philosophical thinking, where you did a lot of the main works, some of the main works of Aristotle and some other key works of philosophy? And he thought that would be actually a huge benefit to the students, and you could do it in a way that was congruent with a real diversity of views of the world. I think something like that could be an amelioration.
If I can say something here, I'm currently teaching an undergraduate class here at Duke on virtue ethics, and we are reading not all of Nicomachean Ethics, but large swaths of it. And my students are 20% Christian, maybe, and 50% nothing, or they're not sure what they're about. And I have received pushback on the point that, look, Aristotle, it was an aristocrat, or they read him as one. He was European. He was a man. He says some cringeworthy things about women and so forth. And my students have a hard time getting past that and seeing what is timeless wisdom in him. I'm doing my best. Maybe I'm failing as a teacher. But it's a real hurdle.
Yeah, and I think those are all, solutions, objections that need to be engaged with substantively. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't dismiss any of them, but I would say there's still a kind of discernment, despite his particular cultural setting, of some structures of human action theory that are perennially helpful. Mm-hmm. Professor Cavadini, I see you have your hand up.
I have maybe just a comment or a question addressed to the respondent. Because I heard the question at the end, and where would the point of leverage be between someone who thinks a horrifying thing that she said and any kind of integrated view of truth? And I felt defeated by what you said, I guess, and tempted to just give up. So resisting that temptation, I want to offer the following comment, and this Robert Wilkin left, but it goes along with the idea of amnesia and recovering memory. Plato, in the Phaedo, so a text that you could read in a first-year philosophy class, he makes this very interesting distinction between a cause and the condition without which the cause can't be operative, right? And so Socrates says, well, what's the cause that I'm sitting here? You all remember this. What's the cause that I'm sitting here? The cause is that I think it was right to sit here instead of escape. And there's all kinds of conditions that would, if they weren't true, physical conditions, would render that cause inoperative. So there's a philosophical distinction in the order of, I guess you could say, cognition, but it's placed within the context of the Phaedo, where he dies in the end, and where Plato is therefore tendering to the reader the specter that if you don't accept this philosophical distinction, you can't admire Socrates. You have no way of saying, yes, this was of all the men that have come around and at this was the bravest. So you've got no way of distinguishing between bravery and the cowardice he could have chosen.
Yeah.
So what I'm pointing to is that the philosophical cognitive argument takes place in a rhetorical context that appeals to conversion, that attempts to convert the reader in some way through its rhetorical force. But will you really go there that bravery can't be distinguished from cowardice?
Okay.
And that something admirable can't be distinguished from something not so admirable?
Yeah.
So in the end, you're left with both a philosophical distinction and an appeal because it's rhetorically couched. And I think I'm haunted by the patristics question from earlier, because one of the ways in which the father's theology was distinctive was that it generally was in a rhetorical context, so that it didn't simply appeal to cognitive distinctions, as clarifying as they can be. It set them in the context of rhetorical persuasive appeal, just like Plato does. In the end, the incarnation is something like that, right? It is God's, not just word, but God's rhetoric, God's attempt to sweetly persuade us and to convert us. So I think what you're pointing to, or what it raises in my own heart, is that there's a certain point where the intellectual leverage seems so minimal. But don't we always get to a point like that, where on some level conversion is required, and you need a kind of rhetorical genre or rhetorical situation of cognitive truths that make that appeal to conversion? It seems like education has got to be as much about that as about clarifying thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thank you. In the classroom, I feel as if I'm most effective with my students when I'm giving anecdotes that are paradigmatic instances of virtue or vice. And then I say to them, don't we all agree this is courage or this is cowardice? And they nod. But then they're quick to try to problematize that by saying, yes, but in Bangladesh, courage looks like this, and therefore, what good is it? How far can you get in building some sort of moral philosophy using virtue like this? So, you know, and I do my best to handle it, but it's these issues of relativism have a way of reasserting themselves.
They do, but
yeah.
But I'm sure you're a more successful teacher than you're letting on. And the kind of power of your witness,
yeah,
asking those questions and keeping at it, it is a rhetorical act, an instructional rhetorical act,
right,
that appeals for a conversion. And
right.
It's something irreducible in education there.
So just to be clear, we're talking about kind of an intellectual conversion here, kind of an aha moment that there's this thing called courage that is durable in some form across cultures, and to be a good human being means to be that, and so forth. Yeah, I preach this gospel every week, and I don't know where I'm getting. I'm only halfway through the semester. But you were supposed to come in today.
It's your first semester teaching.
It is. But he was supposed to guest teach yesterday, and he didn't make it. So.
Yeah, and he's in the first semester
teaching.
He doesn't realize yet. Oh, this is the beginning. This despair is the beginning of hope. Anecdotes. So I thought the belief in the principle of non-contradiction when I was a freshman in college was absurdly like limiting on the human mind and was ridiculous. Only small-minded people think that kind of thing, and I didn't know really what I was talking about. But I had class with Martha Nussbaum, and who was my freshman advisor, and she lectured at length about the principle of non-contradiction. I went around for a day, and then the first principle practical reason, which is to seek in your free usage to do what will lead to happiness and not what will lead to pain or suffering or unhappiness. And I started to remember going around as a freshman for the day thinking about whether I could avoid these two principles and then like basically consenting that they did seem to have... So I was teachable. Okay. I don't know if Martha Nussbaum would be happy about that now. I think she would. And I went to Yale. I was lecturing on Nietzsche and the principle of non-contradiction. And I was at Yale. I had a lot of people there who were like Heideggerian. I ate dinner with them later, and there were a lot of undergraduates who were atheists who were Heideggerian. They decided to come. So I was saying, we could right now be sitting in. It could be true that we are both sitting in this room, and you are dressed as you are, and we're sitting in a room in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and you are all donning crimson, and you're all business majors, and you're all hoping to make $1 million by the time you're 30. They all just started shaking their heads, said, "Oh, well, I've gotten somewhere with you people." That was the emotional rhetorical element. It was horrifying to think they would be business majors at Harvard.
I was once trying to make the point of the principle of non-contradiction to a scholar of Wittgenstein. And if you've ever debated one of these people, it can be maddening. And I said, clearly it's true. And he looked out the window and he said, "Is it raining? Yes and no." And I just thought, what am I supposed to say to that?
Well, let me open the floor back up. We can take a few more questions, and then we'll take a break. We have lunch coming and things like that. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just had a question related to that, with maybe a comment, maybe both. Famously, like Plato's, unhypothetical first principle is the good, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about reason, the life of reason, like being at its base a noble risk. And I wondered when you were talking about coming at someone who is, from such a sort of, shriveled area in terms of what they take reason to be. It strikes me that with Plato, his response to that, and this is not, obviously, I haven't thought of this, I've read this elsewhere, is to sort of go as big as you can go, right? And sort of I'm not going to try to start with the smallest thing. I'm going to, base it on as large as it can be. And that struck me with two comments you made. First, the thing about, for Aquinas, being the first thing being the commonality of being. Is that really so different than that notion of the good as first, because how could being be all in common if it didn't have a unifier? And I don't know why I got a little lost there about the noble risk. Is that sort of an adequate response to that sort of thing? Because is it the heart of the postmodern project maybe this fear of being wrong? And so instead of, being wrong, you just retreat, saying
a reasonable skepticism, a deep and defensively reasonable skepticism about ontological projects. Okay, those are great questions. So let me just say two things about them. The first being, Aristotle has a critique of Plato on the good. It's a critique of the theory of the forms. It's in the first book of the Neocomachean Ethics. It shows up in many places, amongst others, book 11 in the Metaphysics. And I think because Aristotle thinks knowledge does take its point of departure from sensate experiences but is not reducible uniquely to animalistic empirical sensate forms of knowledge, there is a distinctively intellectual, rational, you might say spiritual element of knowledge, but it works through the senses and extracts knowledge. That means that for Aristotle, we only ever start with concrete, individual, singular beings. Okay, so when I say this ens commune or esse commune, Aquinas uses both phrases, common being, common existence. That is actually built up intuitive. You gain knowledge of that abstractly from starting with singulars. So it's not an abstract holism. It's something that you begin with the concrete, and you always return back to the concrete. And your constructs about the universal character of being are always measured by and in relationship back to the actual structure of reality as composed of individual existent things. I just think it's an important move to make, because it means that Aquinas is not working through a kind of transcendental idealism where you start already always from universal notions and then work down to particular sensate realities. Actually, in a way, it works the other way. You go out into the sensate world of actual existent things, you study them, and you realize that there are common traits. One thing that's most common to all of them is they all exist. And he thinks everybody knows this, but almost nobody thinks about it overtly. They just act as if the car on the street exists and it could run them over, so they wait for it to pass before they go through the crosswalk. There's a kind of fundamental realism in forming. You can then thematize that and try to think about what are the conditions for the existence of each of these singular things. You get into universal notions of being. But yes, ultimately that does have a kind of Neoplatonic aspiration to it. The nice thing about that way of going, though, is that it does speak to those who are risk-averse because they're worried about transcendental delusions of reason, and says, no, look, we're looking at the actual structure of reality as we experience it in the singular real forms. Regarding the noble risk idea, I absolutely agree with you that there's a lot of existential vertigo that's at play when people start to think about even engaging in large-scale explanatory theories and ontologies and religious systems and so forth. Now, in Aquinas' lingo, this is sapientia, the aspiration to sapientia, or wisdom, overarching explanations of everything in light of its first principles. Obviously, he thinks monotheism and Trinitarian monotheism are the ultimate form of sapientia, or explanatory orientation. I think without faith, supernatural faith, there's some natural dangers that everyone is at risk for. What are the two risks? On one, if you think about it as moderation, on one extreme, you have the risk of unwarranted excessive skepticism. So I will stay in the cave of my mind. You can't make me come out. I'll put up all kinds of skeptical arguments. And I think of Hume as a very, very brilliant person like this, who has reasoned well so as to sequester himself in the prison of his own skeptical mind, because of the dangers that would be evoked by entering into deep kind of ontological theories of things. But the other side is, of course, superstitio and philosophical or religious madness. And that is actually no less a danger. So religious irrationality, I mean, Aquinas has this category of superstitio. We've forgotten about this. I think we either want to say all religion's good or all religion's bad. There's bad religion. And there's bad religion in Christianity, and I don't mean like Protestantism or Catholicism. I mean there's bad ways of being a religious person intellectually that are present before modernity and in modernity. There's bad ways of being pathologically religious outside of Christianity. So I think some of the fears are reasonable. And I think without supernatural faith in the fallen world, it's very hard for people to start getting their bearings, because they feel like it's all on them, and they don't have a tradition. It's overwhelming. How can you resolve all this on your own? So that's where I think both tradition and supernatural grace are really helpful for the natural philosophical intellectual life, to have the courage to search in teamwork with other people who are mentors, who are actually trying to help you and not destroy you, who have a non-superstitious form of religious intellectual life. So the intellectual tradition of the Christian intellectual tradition in that sense, and the kind of deeper like knowledge of Christ by grace that go with it, are very important for stabilizing and allowing an agile intellectual life that's not overly characterized by fear or weird, raw daring. Yeah.
Dr. Rose, you mentioned at one point that one of the goals might be, and this is me sticking up for the Wittgensteinians, treating the being of things before they become part of a culture. And I just wonder if framing the question in this way renders any sort of answer difficult, just because what it seems to assume is that the ways that we go about talking about describing being in its variety of instantiations is going to be somehow we could do that without being a part of a culture. And it strikes me that the that the emphasis that's been placed today on tradition, right, and tradition's knowledge exactly, it must prevent us from doing something like that, right? So I'd just be curious to have you say a bit more about that.
Thanks for the question. I didn't mean to imply that we could ever reason our way to the things in themselves without going through culture. I mean, this is the so-called myth of the given. There's no thing given like that. But I wanted to put forward the idea that always, and this is a Christian belief, it's a Platonic belief, that we insist that there is the thing itself, and truth, beauty, goodness being the greatest of ontological transcendentals of this kind, that we're always striving towards, and we believe it's there. So yes, you go through tradition, experience, all these things. I didn't mean to imply, if this is what you thought, that you could just jump to that. Do you have something to say to this?
Well, I don't know. I was taught this very simple distinction in my sort of, you know, seminary education by Thomas between those things that condition human knowledge and those things that determine human knowledge, and not to oppose the conditions of human knowledge with the determinations, but not to confuse them either.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the intellect is determined by trying to find the truth about things, but the conditions for finding the truth about things are often the mediations of explanations or analyses provided to us by others. I do think we have immediate access to reality and can analyze structures of things, but we're aided to perceive reality, just like we do with children in a very simple way, by pointing out nature, artifactual properties and natures and things by language and teaching them to denote those and name them. I think on a higher level, the intellect gets in its much more complex functions. People can teach us to reason well and you might say demonstratively about reality. And so the culture of rational articulation, logic, demonstration, reading the right resources, thinking through things rigorously is vital. But in and through that process of conditioning of human knowledge and the rich sociology and linguistic texture that it has, we're reaching the very determinatio, the thing in itself. So there's no opposition between the determinate object of the intellect and the conditions of its exercise. And we don't want to confuse them either.
Yeah, because you began by naming Wittgenstein, and his line is, correct me if I'm wrong here, something regarding the creation of animals, that the animals come when they're named. Do I have this right? Something like, and the notion being, you need the language for it, you need the words for it before the thing can even exist, or we don't have a concept of the thing. Is this, do I have this wrong? Is this not Wittgenstein?
Well, do you want to say you don't want to say the naming gives it being, or do you want to say it gives the intellectual life shape? Is that what you're saying?
I'm opposing this idea.
Oh, I
think this is an idea of modern linguistic philosophy that you have to have a name for it.
I wouldn't want to
make a Wittgenstein, but I wouldn't call. I'm a Wittgensteinian.
All right, so I better tread carefully here. But if that is a belief held by linguists, I want to oppose that, and I think Aquinas opposes it. That's all I'm trying to say.
Making the distinction the way Father Thomas Joseph has made it is helpful in that they're not oppositional, and so that I would also just want to maintain that
as long
as we don't see those two things as opposed. I think that's the right way.
Yep. Why don't we take this as a last question? Yes, sir.
Yeah, if I can, and it's kind of not exactly a question. It's actually kind of to press one of the issues of the questions that was asked earlier about kind of like what is this idea of an integrated. Is Catholic knowledge university type thing, and to kind of press that issue, and especially if you father as the director of the Thomistic Institute here, because I think this is kind of doing that, and I'll get to why. I want to point out five quick themes that both of you gentlemen brought up that were shared by you and have kind of been shared by the discussion. I want to bring them up just real quick because they've been repeated so often. That is, the first one is the unity of knowledge. And the reason that there is a unity of knowledge is because that's part of the ontological structure of reality. Going on from there, there is some of the problems are that in academia, the knowledge and the discussion of the disciplines are siloed. leading to a balkanization of different disciplines. The humanities specifically are under-resourced compared to the different STEM fields, especially like at this institution. And one of the major consequences of that is there's a lack of, by the end of your educational process, there's a lack of shared understanding of reality as people go out into the world. And so I kind of say this, so the reason I bring it up is because I myself am not an academic. I think this is my second time in an academic institution's library since I graduated college in 2004, which would make exactly twice the amount of times that I actually went to one in college. The importance of that is because, as Professor, as you said over here, is at least as far as the intellectual awakening, there's definitely hope, and I would, you know, offer myself as that a little bit. I mean, this is firmly within the grace of God, but I had my at least intellectual awakening on who Aristotle was, or who Plato was, or whatever. I had mine in the middle of the desert in Afghanistan when I was trying to help some district governor of a district no one's ever heard of, won't hear of again, and may God have mercy on that man's soul because he died a year after I left. But, you know, was killed in the fashion that people get killed over there. But it was like we're trying to help them build governance, and I had to ask the question, what is governance? Right? By the end of that experience, when you're trying to bring people together to have some sort of unified, this is how we do things, and no one has been educated in 3 to 4 generations because of war, and all we want to do is shove paper, all we were trying to do was shove paperwork down an illiterate culture's throat and tell them that was governed. I think that there has to be, so the reason I bring these points up and want to kind of press the issue with both you gentlemen is because I think that there has to be a practical solution, a practical way by which the discussion here reaches society, because people have already left these institutions without a shared understanding of what society, what reality is, and you know, we're kind of separated from that a little bit. And I think the Thomistic Institute is a fantastic way because, like I said, it was open.
All right. Well, we're going to put you on the next brochure. I think that was a very coherent, you know, set of observations about what people are saying, and it's a very reasonable question. Just if I say something brief about what your experience seems to me to denote from what you briefly said about it is the limits of utilitarianism, and the need when you're trying to build a deeper structure of a culture of justice to have references to deep notions of human nature, human well-being, and political life. What I would just say briefly on the political level is that my concern, this is a bigger topic than what we're talking about today, although it's very interesting to muse on briefly. My concern about what happens in what's the cultural effect of an increasingly disintegrated university education? I think on the one hand, then you peddle as the kind of philosophical, ethical resource for larger culture, a supposedly cosmopolitan liberalism, which has perhaps arguably someone like John Rawls as its deepest theoretical articulation and impulse, which does not seem adequate to all of people's human experience and does not account for a lot of the more complex elements of human culture, and there's a revolt against that. And then you've got people looking for some kind of substitute for a truly universal and richer metaphysical understanding of the human person, which typically takes the forms of really problematic neo-nationalism, which I think we do see reemergent in Europe in the wake of de-Christianization and in as a kind of a not very well thematized response to the perceived threats or maybe real threats of Islamicization and immigration. And there's not a sufficient universal ethical and political and philosophical vision to be able in a sufficiently unified way to create polity. And I think the danger then is you get tribalism. And I think we have to be very concerned right now about political tribalism being exacerbated by the thin veneer of cosmopolitan liberalism that doesn't give a deep and rich enough account of human existence. And so, you know, I think there probably are larger political stakes. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.